across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Will Bowden. He's got an interesting story. It's part Coast Guard, part business, part marijuana growing. So this is not your normal business entrepreneur here. So, Will, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. It's really, really nice to be here. I appreciate the invite.
Well, it's always great to talk to a Coastie, and we do on Veterans Radio. We talk to a lot of veteran entrepreneurs and businessmen. I think sometimes the image of us veterans is that, you know, we're all kind of broken down guys, and we're not. Generally, we take our skills that we learned in the service and turn them to really interesting and positive life outside of the military service. But let's talk first, how did a nice kid like you end up in the Navy and move to the Coast Guard and have the career that you had?
You know, the irony has not been lost on anybody, for sure, Jim. So I was born and raised in Santa Cruz, California, and the only reason I go back that far is because, you know, this was an area that was very accepting of cannabis. But my choices in life, law enforcement and military, did not allow me to participate either from a work or use perspective, right? So I joined the Navy shortly after high school, and I went into military law enforcement, did a couple of things there pre-9/11, and had a really, really good time there. And as I transitioned off of active duty to reserve, I went into the Coast Guard Reserve. And what's funny about that is I thought that that was actually going to keep me in some geographical areas within the United States. I ended up in a unit in the Coast Guard that actually does not deploy in the United States. It only deploys overseas, right? Ended up being just a really rewarding tour in the Coast Guard, and a nice way to start the Coast Guard. It's called a port security unit. And then 9/11 happens, and I become more active in my time in the reserve time than I was the whole time I was on active duty. So it was just, you know, everybody appreciates that no matter who you were in the military, very, very active time since then. So all along that time, so when I transitioned from active duty to reserve, I also joined on as a police officer down in Naples, Florida in Collier County. And I had an amazing time at the police department there as well. Serving from road patrol all the way till I exited when I was on the SWAT team. The reason why I left the police department was because I went to school to get my MBA. And while I was going to get my MBA, I thought it would be neat to work in corporate America. And Florida has a nice way of allowing people with their active law enforcement license to leave and do other things and come back within a 5-year period and maintain that licensure. So when I went to my administration and I said, hey, I'd like to go do this, they were completely supportive of it, amazing mentors and leaders there. And so I went and did that. That's what took me to a pharmaceutical company, Merck. Okay. And I'm still Coast Guard Reserve at that time too. So I go there, I finish my MBA program, and Merck ends up offering me a pretty cool position. They said, hey, why don't you come up to headquarters? We're about to change our US commercial model. And I was really excited about that because I just got done doing my MBA program. This was stuff that was totally going to make sense. So I went back to my same administration and they're like, oh, it sounds like an amazing opportunity. It's only supposed to be about a year. So I go up to Pennsylvania from Florida and I start to work with Merck. And basically what ends up happening over the next 14 years was I really enjoyed the work that Merck was throwing me from an intellectual perspective. And I was still getting my sense of duty and service from doing all those stuff I was doing in the Coast Guard. And again, I was being deployed all the time and not even CONUS. I was being deployed overseas. So doing really interesting work with the Coast Guard too. So I just never went back to law enforcement, which is funny because now, you know, my cop buddies will call me and laugh at the fact that I'm in the Canada.
Yeah, right. Now, so. Yeah, you've gone to the other end of the spectrum. But because we so rarely get to talk to Coast Guard folks, and I should say Will Bone retired as a lieutenant commander, tell us about some of those overseas assignments. I don't think folks really appreciate the depth and breadth of tasks that the Coast Guard gets pulled into.
Yeah, so first of all, the Coast Guard has stations all over the world, and that's something that we all don't appreciate. The things that we appreciate is the things we tend to see, right? So you see things like search and rescue, you see things like drug interdiction, you see things like hazardous materials cleanups and stuff like that. What we don't see is some of the units that were actually developed before and during Vietnam, the riverine patrols, and a lot of the support that was happening during those days. So Coast Guard has been longstanding of being small boat experts. And small boats can be like your 24-foot boats. It also can mean your small cutters compared to the larger ships that the Navy would have, right? So being very small and agile, being a smaller specialized organization, afforded the Coast Guard to develop those skills and be very complementary when working with the Marine Corps, the United States Navy, Air Force in some cases too, and definitely with the Army at times too. So one of my first deployments with the Coast Guard was actually to Guantanamo. We went down there and we were a part of the initial detainee ops of when they were bringing detainees right after 9/11 to Guantanamo. And we were a part of the initial efforts to stand up that operation, establish good security protocols, working very closely again with the different entities that were already down there. And I don't think a lot of people understand that that's one of the places that we would deploy to and operate in. We were also active the entire time and continue to be active the entire time in the Middle East and all the Middle East operations that were going on. Not everybody understands that we have a presence over there and what we do. I think when you think about the Coast Guard deploying overseas, what you want to think about is land or structure scenarios that touch water that need to establish normalization and security, right? So that could be the oil platforms in the Middle East. That could be Guantanamo Bay having a high threat security zone in a bay down there. And everything in between. That's one of the sweet spots that the Coast Guard does very well.
Well, and we've had some guests on Veterans Radio, and we're talking to Lieutenant Commander Will Bowden of the United States Coast Guard, retired. We've talked to guests about the Coast Guard being deployed in the Pacific over concerns with Taiwan and China. Again, those are things I think in general people don't know that the Coast Guard's out doing that, but you sort of summarized it, the phrase of small boat experts really, you know, kind of helps you visualize where they are and what they can do.
It is. And, you know, there's a combined effort out there and sometimes we forget. So one of my final assignments was at the time it was called PACOM of the Combatant Command, Pacific Command, but it's been since renamed Indo-Pacific Command. In that Combatant Command, they have jurisdiction for 52% of the world, like the Pacific Ocean and all of the continents and countries that touch that Pacific Ocean. And so I got to work in a really neat policy group that really focused on Northeast Asia with a more of a focus on Korea and North Korea and China. So when you think about that kind of work, you don't automatically think of Coast Guard there. But at the end of the day, what you are talking about is the United States military working together to accomplish the goals that we need to accomplish both operationally and policy-wise in the world today. And that requires everybody. That requires non-government entities as well as government entities. We had non-military entities at PACOM as well as your military partners as well. And it is a bigger picture than I think most of us see. But again, we tend to believe in the things that we see. So there's movies, there's television, there's my uncle was in whatever. And that's the stuff that we formulate our opinions on, right?
It is. And that's why we do these shows on Veterans Radio, to tell real life stories that broaden out those pictures. And we always kind of end up asking the same question, which is, based on your experiences in the Coast Guard, if your niece, nephew, family member, friend, son of a friend came in and said, you know, I'm thinking I should do something like this, what do you think about an opportunity in the Coast Guard? Where does it take you?
So Jim, this is so great, because one of the things that I take very seriously is coaching people in general, but coaching kids who aspire to explore something in the military. And my favorite example of this is, somebody might come to me and say, hey, I want to go fly jets, so I'm going to join the Air Force. And I don't throw them the obvious thing of where else jets are. I say, well, that's awesome, but do you know that the Army has more aircraft than the Air Force has? And that usually stops them in their tracks. And then said, I'm not asking you to join the Army. What I'm asking you to do is just do more digging, be more curious, because you're going to join an organization that has a bunch of different jobs that are in that organization. And chances are you might want to try a few of those jobs in there. So make sure that you understand not just the job you're gunning for and you want to join, but also what are the other jobs that you would maybe want to see or try or work alongside as well. And it's really just getting people to do a bit more diligence, especially our youth, to say there's a lot of amazing jobs. There's amazing jobs in the Coast Guard and the Navy that never see the water. There's amazing jobs in the Air Force that never see aircraft, right? So you just have to understand that it's a bigger world out there than the thing that's tending to motivate you, which usually is that father, that uncle, that movie, you know, the thing that grabs your attention when you're a kid, as it should when you're a kid. But as we get older and we're graduating high school and we're considering military service, there's more diligence that usually can benefit people, for sure.
Well, I want to congratulate you on doing that sort of mentoring, because I think we all have a responsibility who've served to be talking to the younger generation about the value of it, the skill sets you're going to receive, the crazy places you're going to get sent to and see the world,
sure,
even though you thought you were only be deployed in the U.S. So all of those are positive things. But I want to transition, as I said, we like talking to veteran business entrepreneurs, and you moved from law enforcement to the corporate world, were doing really well and is successful with a huge company there. What in the world made you transfer those skill sets that you had learned along the way? And Will is the CEO of Grasshopper Farms, which is a marijuana growing operation in multiple states, all outdoors. But we'll talk about Grasshopper Farms in a minute. But I want to start with like the mental process going on as you as you transferred your skill sets into this being this veteranpreneur.
Well, you couldn't have labeled it better than the mental process, because that's exactly what happened. So really what happens here is I retired October of 2018. So that was the moment when I exited the military. But before that, a good 10, 12 years ago, I was watching the cannabis industry and I was appreciating it for the business perspective of what it's doing, and then for the medical perspective of what it's doing too. There's amazing things going on that go way beyond the Narcos Mexico and reefer madness that we really need to understand better. But so I was already appreciating it, but it was always from afar, because it was not something that I was allowed to do simply because of my military service. And I was really enjoying that. So the same month I retire, I end up meeting another guy who was also former military, and we're just getting to know each other. But when he learned that I had prior law enforcement experience, the things I had done in the Coast Guard, and then my pharmaceutical experience, he said, hey, I want to offer you a job. I'm like, oh, what's that? He goes, well, he's starting what we call in the industry an MSO, multi-state operator. And he wanted me to help him go operationalize licenses in other states. And so I go home to my wife. I'm like, is this really happening? You can't make this up. I mean, it's just like, it's crazy. It's the same exact month I retired. So that was a bit of a jarring moment, mentally speaking, right? But at the end of the day, I talked it over with my wife. I was really excited about a new opportunity, almost in the same way of like being excited for a new command as we rotate through military service, right? And so I sat down with my wife and we said yes. So I started and I went to work for him, learning the industry. First, I was sent to Michigan to operationalize licenses. I got 3 retail locations up and running and got indoor grower up and running, some manufacturing was in the pipeline. But all along that time, I developed an appreciation for the outdoor farming aspect of the industry. So that's kind of what broke me into this.
There's not a lot of farmland in Santa Cruz, California that you're relating to here. This isn't a family I want to grow up to be a farmer thing. How did you say, well, that's the, I like this field because it's brand new and a lot of opportunity. How did you decide outdoor grows my niche?
So as I was going through all of this, it's really important as you enter any business that you really understand what are your operating costs. And when you do that analysis on indoor cultivation, you start to realize that energy in the form of power is going to be one of the main drivers of your operating costs. And so as I was looking at that, I was like, okay, so why aren't more people growing outside? And at the same time, I came across a study that was done back in 2011. So we're talking 12 years ago now, that basically said that indoor cannabis cultivation was occupying 1% of the U.S. power grid. And I was like, ooh, not sustainable. And it's not that indoor grow is bad and needs to be demonized or anything. That's not the case. It's just we haven't realized our balance yet of indoor greenhouse and outdoor grows, right? That's what it comes down to. So I got really curious and I started doing the research and I started trying to figure out, so why aren't more people doing the outdoor farm? Well, long story short, it's because farming is really, really hard. I will tell you that right now. Okay. So, but I started looking at the business model of it. And the other on the business side of it is when a person would go into a retail cannabis store, they would see different grades of indoor flower that they could select from. But usually there was only one grade of outdoor flower. Usually it's discounted and considered to be lesser quality. And I said, well, that's just not right. This plant was outside. And the only reason why it even went inside was because it became illegal and people went into basements and pole barns. And that's just where it kind of evolved into. And people then, not surprisingly, have stuck with that discipline because not just over decades, but generations, they've learned how to do that well. So now it's time to come back outside and do it well, though, because there's plenty of people who have done it well and can do it well. So let's do it. So that's what I did. I formed the team. I left that last company and started this company. And we went to market saying that I think that what we can do is provide a higher quality of outdoor flower than is available in the market today in Michigan. It ended up working out. So we expanded to Colorado, now New Jersey too. And we're working our way into Minnesota and Massachusetts. And I want to try to build a collective of 10 farms is kind of the goal here, 10 different teams as we continue the mission.
Well, you've just identified a number of states, including Michigan, which are not warm weather states. They have a specific grow season. How does that factor into all this analysis that you're doing, which is probably pretty deep, thus the MBA, thus the operational role at the Coast Guard where you were doing a lot of planning, but how do you look at this from outdoor grow operations and the seasonality of it all?
Well, first and foremost, if you're going to pick to do outdoor farming, you better operate where other outdoor farms exist. And then you got to pay attention to what exists as far as an outdoor farm goes as well. So where we're set up in Michigan, we're surrounded by blueberry farms. And if you can grow blueberries, grapes, or tomatoes, you're probably in the right vicinity, geographically speaking, to do an outdoor cannabis farm there too. So location, 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 right? It's just, you got to know what state you're going into, what kind of seasonality. You also mentioned there is a season. You're absolutely right. We are a single season outdoor grow, which means we produce a crop once a year. So we have to be very deliberate in what we do throughout that year to support being able to produce the amount that we need to run a business, right? So there's a lot of math that goes into that for sure. But when it comes down to picking the state or where in the state, because Michigan, much like California, is much different at the bottom of Michigan from a growing perspective than it is up to what they call the UP or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I would recommend you probably don't want to do an outdoor grow for retail flower in the Upper Peninsula. You might do it for a smaller scale and for biomass, but you just have to be careful on these things. There's ways to do them in a lot of different locations, but you got to be very deliberate in knowing what's going to work in that location and then go after that.
So when did Grasshopper Farms get started, Will?
Yep. So we started in 2020. The name Grasshopper Farms, Grasshopper represents two things for us. One is that we are on a journey of always learning. And the second one is the grasshopper hops from season to season. Because we are a single season outdoor grow, we don't benefit from things that like vines for grapes and blueberries that we can revive. We literally have to start over with new plants every single year.
And in those three years now going, you've opened up in Colorado, Michigan, and New Jersey. How many acres do you have?
So in Michigan, we bought 160 acres, but it's important to say out loud that we only developed 40 of those acres. And the reason why is because we were bringing a new type of flower to the market. And so to do that, that means that we have to have a lot of focus and discipline. So we started by building out 40 acres because we knew that we could logistically operate that with a high degree of precision, and we would not expand until we honed in our practices. And then also the market dictated that it would be appropriate to expand. So we've done that. We're ready now to expand in Michigan to an appropriate level, which will probably be just another 40 acres. And we'll probably stop there. That will probably be what Grasshopper Farms is in Michigan. So for each state, what we're going to do is we're going to always have that focus and discipline so that we don't get distracted with shiny objects. We really stick to the mission, and we're able then to provide that quality and consistency. And you're probably going to say, well, we could just substitute some of the names and call it a military operation, and you're absolutely right. That's exactly what it is.
I was laughing at the focus and getting away from the shiny objects. It is a, as I say, a new kind of niche business, right, that there's not a lot of folks you can look to and talk to and say, well, how did you do it? But how much of this becomes then a marketing and outlet? Because, you grew it. You pick those flowers once a year. It's now got to be processed. It's now get to retail. There's a more integrated part of the industry. Talk to us a little bit about how you approach that.
Yeah, Jim, you're absolutely right there. So look, when we came to market, we told everybody, hey, we're Grasshopper Farms, and you're going to know us because we're going to produce premium sun-grown flower. And everybody kind of gave us that virtual pat on the back and said, sure, you're going to, buddy. You go out there and do your thing.
Yeah,
it's
good
really
luck.
Hard to do. Yeah, that's right. There's a reason why most of the outdoor flower out there is in a discounted, lower quality status. And that's because it's really hard to do. And those farms also focus on biomass for making things like edibles, topicals, sublinguals, and before. So when we came to market, we had to be deliberate about what we were saying about who we are and how we're doing it, right? So we were building a brand at that point too. And so this is really important. When you're running a business, you not only have to know what product or service are you selling, but how are you going to communicate that to people as well? And that's the marketing aspect of that. So we initially started out there when we had no product to sell by going around and telling our story. We went around to retailers. We started talking about it on Facebook and Instagram. We went to a couple of conventions and we just told our story. And then we just said, I know what you guys all think this is going to be hard to do and maybe impossible, but just give us a try when we come out. And then what that did was it let the onus fall on us to produce what we knew we could, right? So we produced a product that ended up being a higher quality outdoor flower than was typically available. And retailers and consumers did accept us for that. And because we did all of that marketing work and continue to do all that marketing work, it's now developed a conversation with people in the United States and even outside the United States where they're paying attention to what we're doing, and we've built a name for ourselves. And I think that's really important in any industry that you do that. You've got to build a name for yourself so that when other folks try to do what you're doing, it's fine that they do, but you've already solidified your name in this too. Much in the way that in early days of Sam Adams, they never tried to compete with your Coors and Budweisers, right? They just made a solid craft beer is what they did. And I know they're a lot bigger now, but eventually in our industry, you're going to have some legalization changes occur. You're going to have some bigger companies come in. And if you haven't made your name for yourself as a smaller company, you run the risk of possibly getting just run over by those larger companies. So how do we do that? You spend the time, you tell your story, you make a name for yourself. And let's not forget, you got to have that quality and consistency
gotta
of
produce.
Whatever the product or service.
Got to produce. Got a mission accomplished. You know, one of the reasons besides being a Coast Guard alum, and we love talking to you guys because you're hard to find, but veterans in particular are very interested in the cannabis world, the use of cannabis, the medicinal use of cannabis. They run afoul at times, you know, because it's still a federally scheduled drug. They run afoul with VA sometimes, although that's loosening up. There's some legislation to do more VA research on the benefits of cannabis. But by and large, a lot of interest in veterans in the use of cannabis because of the quality of life that it provides to them. I'm wondering, as with your background and with where Grasshopper Farms are located and what you plan on doing, how do you see the veteran world intersecting with what you're doing in the business and even in the employee world of yours?
Yeah, so a few different layers there. So I think a lot of folks, when they were getting to know the medicinal benefits of cannabis, there was, I think, a lot of references to things like glaucoma and cancer. And definitely those things exist for sure. For me, it was more so on the side of talking to men and women who had served and were now benefiting from cannabis from either combat injuries or PTSD. It's just, at this point, I've lost track of how many I've talked to who benefited from it from that specific angle. And it's really important to understand that cannabis has incredible medicinal value. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. It is a strong medicinal candidate for so many things out there, but we're just scratching the surface right now because we're in a phase right now where it was illegal for so long, and the Reagan and Nixon administrations were so good at their anti-drug campaigns and including cannabis in it. So now what we're learning is that cannabis probably shouldn't have been in it. It probably is, you know, definitely is not a gateway drug. In fact, I've been calling it a reverse gateway drug because it has been helping people to have a healthier relationship with things like pain medication and alcohol. And so when you start to see this used appropriately, or just used for sleep, there's so many people who are sleep deprived today that are not diagnosed as a medical condition, and they use it for sleep, and they don't even think they're using it medically. They take the stigma of using it recreationally when in fact they're not. They're using it to get something that's one of the most important factors that you need in the world, which is a good night's sleep of both quantity and quality, right? So I think that the implications federally certainly are they need to be contemplated and understood, the severity of the scheduling and how that impacts men and women who might be able to benefit from this in the service. I think that that will start to ease up as the federal changes happen, as the VA learns more, and as more research becomes available too. As far as our position right now and how we're trying to help, we actually just had a former Marine come and visit our farm with three of his friends, and he benefits from a program in Michigan that actually affords him to have free access to cannabis products to help him with the combat injuries that he sustained from his service. And we were introduced to that program, and now we're going to contribute product to that program as well to make sure that we're contributing to that free access that he can obtain in the state of Michigan. And I'm glad the state of Michigan has actually stepped up and doing something for military veterans who need this product to basically just have quality of life. And then as far as veterans go, listen, anytime I can grab a veteran and put them on the team, that's going to happen because we already come from a foundation that we can understand together. And I know what I'm already working with when I hire a veteran. So I'll hire a veteran every day of the week for whatever positions that we have within our organization, for sure.
Well, that's why we're talking to Will Bowden, CEO of Grasshopper Farms, which grows outdoor cannabis in three states. He's a lieutenant commander from the United States Coast Guard Reserve, retired now. And Will, I think, getting the message out to more folk is part of what's necessary to do. There are a lot of people in that industry, and you know, you can probably pick your industry and say, there's some sketchy folks. But I think it's important to, as you say, get out, talk about what you're going to do, and then follow through and do it. And that's what you're in the process of now. Just quickly, because we're running a little long, yeah, are you growing yet in Colorado or New Jersey?
Yeah, so we had a full season this year in Colorado. They're in the middle of Michigan and Colorado are both in the midst right now of an outdoor harvest. In New Jersey, we've received all of our state licensure, and we're just waiting for the final licensure from Galloway Township. And then we'll be what I would call plant touching at that point and operational. So I would expect that within 90 days or less, we'll be plant touching within New Jersey as well.
Well, that's great. That's great expansion. It's got to be exciting to be in the middle of harvest, and we appreciate you taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio and educate us about cannabis, outdoor cannabis growing in particular, and that transition from military to law enforcement to veteran entrepreneur in the cannabis space. So we really do appreciate the time today.
Well, thanks, Jim. And it's not just an honor. I also consider it a duty. We got to help each other out. And the way we do that is we support each other through communication and helping each other to discover paths that work and then support each other to success. So my honor. Thank you very much.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans. And you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Press Corps Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.